Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 13th of April, these are our main stories. Fresh revelations from a major leak of classified US government documents suggest that Washington believes the UN Secretary General has been too willing to accommodate Russian interests. An unprecedented analysis of how cancers grow has concluded that a universal cure is unlikely anytime soon. The bodies of six inmates have been found hanged inside a cell in one of Ecuador's most notorious prisons. Also in this podcast,
it's a close-up of an image of an eye wearing eyeshadow on an Asian model. But you can see the model is using one of her fingers to push up the outside of her eye.
After an ill-thought-through ad, could fashion brand Dior face a Chinese boycott? The US Department of Defense is continuing to deal with the fallout of one of the largest leaks of classified material in recent years, most of it relating to the war in Ukraine. The documents also indicate, embarrassingly, but perhaps not surprisingly, that the US has been eavesdropping on its allies, including South Korea, Israel, and Egypt. And in the latest revelation from the leak, documents show the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, was amongst those being closely monitored, and Washington concluded he was being soft on Russia. I got more from our diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams.
It's a phenomenal dump of information. It may not be that many documents, several dozen, but there are fascinating fragments, and they deal with a whole host of issues, not just the war in Ukraine, which is the bulk of it, but a lot of other issues too. And in certain instances, it provides for very awkward reading for people who are being eavesdropped on, including, not for the first time, it has to be said, the world's chief diplomat, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. Everyone knows that everyone spies on the UN. But here we are with him talking to his deputy about the aftermath of an African Union summit, expressing rather candid views on various African leaders. His deputy, Amina Mohamed, describing Kenya's President William Ruto as ruthless, and she doesn't trust him. You know, that's not the kind of thing anyone at the UN wants anyone in Africa to be listening to. And also on the subject of Mr. Guterres and Ukraine, there is a view clearly expressed in one of the documents by the Americans that Mr. Guterres is so intent on preserving that grain deal, the Black Sea Grain Initiative, the deal that was brokered by the UN last summer to make sure that Ukrainian grain could exit Ukrainian ports and help to feed the world's hungry, that in the view of the Americans, Mr. Guterres is being too accommodating of Russian interests, including where they involve individuals or companies under Western sanctions. His actions, according to the Americans, are undermining broader efforts to hold Moscow accountable for its actions in Ukraine. Now, clearly, that is something that that UN officials would dispute. They would say that it is of vital importance to make sure that this global food crisis is addressed, and that grain deal was an important part of that. And I think they would also dispute the idea that Mr. Guterres has been anything other than candid with the Russians about the war in Ukraine.
Paul Adams. As the US Department of Defense deals with that major leak of classified government documents, the country's president, Joe Biden, continues his visit to Ireland. Mr. Biden, who's fiercely proud of his Irish heritage, will meet with government officials and distant relatives. On Wednesday afternoon, he flew across the border from Belfast into Dublin on Air Force One. Then he met local people in County Louth, a short distance from the Irish border, telling them, "It feels wonderful. It feels like I'm coming home." Just hours earlier, Mr. Biden addressed an audience in Belfast as Northern Ireland marks the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement, the deal which helped to end the Troubles, the decades-long sectarian conflict which killed thousands.
Thousands of families have been affected by the Troubles. Losses are real. The pain was personal. I need not tell many people in this audience. Every person killed in the Troubles left an empty chair at that dining room table and a hole in the heart. It was never filled for the ones they lost. Peace was not inevitable. We can't ever forget that. There was nothing inevitable about it. As George Mitchell often said, the negotiations had, quote, 700 days of failure and one day of success. 700 days of failure and one day of success. But they kept going because George and all the many others never stopped believing that success was possible.
He was referring there to George Mitchell, who was the former US senator who helped negotiate the peace deal. Mr. Biden said he hoped the current political parties in Northern Ireland would be able to bridge their considerable differences. The government there hasn't been fully operating for more than a year because of a dispute about Brexit trading arrangements. Off camera, the US president met the local political leaders and at a local hotel. In the glare of the media, Mr. Biden had coffee with the British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. The BBC's Chris Page followed Wednesday's events in Belfast, including that speech by Mr. Biden.
Northern Ireland is more familiar with US presidential visits than many parts of the world. This was the seventh such occasion in less than 30 years. As always, the arrival of the president generated cheers, protests and a huge security operation. After holding talks with Rishi Sunak, Joe Biden travelled for a mile through Belfast city centre in his motorcade. His only public engagement was at Ulster University's new campus. He spoke about how Belfast felt so different to the place he visited in 1991.
The dividends of peace are all around us, and this very campus is situated in an intersection where conflict and bloodshed once held a terrible sway. Where barbed wire once sliced up the city, today we find a cathedral of learning built of glass. It just has a profound impact for someone who's come back to see it.
Mr. Biden acknowledged the peace wasn't perfect. The president said the politicians who'd signed the Good Friday Agreement 25 years ago had taken risks to largely end the conflict. He called for politicians today to show more courage to enable the devolved government to return. But his tone indicated he was aware of the need for delicate diplomacy amidst political sensitivities.
As a friend, I hope it's not too presumptuous for me to say that I believe democratic institutions established through the Good Friday Agreement remain critical to the future of Northern Ireland. So I hope the Assembly and the Executive will soon be restored. That's a judgment for you to make, not me, but I hope it happens.
I spoke to our political correspondent, Rob Watson, who's also in Belfast. So President Biden hopes for power sharing to be restored there. What exactly does he mean and how close are we to this?
So it's very hard to answer how close we are. Of course, the decision rests with the main Unionist Party. The Democratic Unionist Party wants, of course, to maintain Northern Ireland's place within the United Kingdom. The thinking is here, Nick, and who knows whether it's correct, but if you talk to politicians and commentators, that the hope is, I should put it that way, that the Democratic Unionist Party will return to devolved government, but that it probably won't happen until later in the year. And of course, the problem with that is that you have a vacuum in all sorts of senses, a political vacuum and a vacuum, frankly, in dealing with the things that the people here really care about, just as they do everywhere else, which is inflation, cost of living, the provision of health.
And I suppose for the longer it goes on, the longer the uncertainty, there are dissident groups on both sides who would not mind a return to violence. Their perhaps kudos grows in the chaos.
Yes, potentially, although I think the view of the security threat is that it's something that the intelligence services, that the police want to keep an eye on. I don't think anyone here either thinks or wants that there would be a return to the sort of scale of violence that was seen in the 1970s, 1980s and the early part of the 1990s. So that's not really it. It's just this idea that the people of Northern Ireland are just going to get thoroughly fed up if they don't feel that they're getting the kind of governance they need. And it's not so much that would lead to violence, but more that it just leads to more despair and apathy, which is sort of bad news for the politicians and obviously bad news for all the people that live here.
Indeed. Joe Biden has now gone south of the border, where his ancestors emigrated to America from. How important is President Biden's connection for him to the Irish heritage?
I think it's hugely important. I mean, I think he's proud of his Irish ancestry. He talks about it all the time. And I don't think there's any doubt that this part of the trip is very personal as well as political. Of course, people will point out that given that there are 30 million Americans who claim Irish ancestry, should he just by chance, Nick, decide he's going to run again for the presidency? It wouldn't do any harm to have all those pictures now, would it?
That was Rob Watson in Northern Ireland. There may have been strides in curing cancers in recent decades, but on Wednesday, there was a warning from some scientists that cancers can evolve and mutate and circumvent treatment. In essence, they're saying that we shouldn't expect blockbuster cures anytime soon. Evan Davis asked the BBC's health and science correspondent, James Gallagher, to explain more.
This has been a mega project that's been taking place pretty much over the past decade to really understand how tumours change inside our body. Because you might think of a tumour as just being largely this static thing that just grows, but actually deep within it, there are huge changes taking place. So different parts of the tumour are genetically different to other bits of the tumour, and that all changes over time as the tumour basically evolves to become more aggressive, better at evading your immune system and learning how to basically spread around your body. So it was a mega study to understand that process and how that happens over the course of someone's disease.
And they find these tumours in a way, perhaps more like a bacteria, not but we think of bacteria as evolving and evading.
You're thinking along the right lines. That dynamic between bacteria and antibiotics and the treatments that we use is very similar to the dynamic you get between a cancer and our own immune systems that are trying to fight it. And you get this evolutionary war taking place between the two. Now, the thing is, these are some of the world's leading scientists looking at this, and they said that the product of this series of studies, it's taken 7 scientific papers to summarise all the information that they've done that's all been published. They said they were taken aback, surprised and genuinely in awe of the amount of evolution and the adaptability of cancers in the human body that they have been able to witness through the course of this study, that they actually have come to the conclusion that they really think we need to shift far more to focusing on how do we prevent cancers forming in the first place. Because when you end up with this evolutionary monster at the end of it, finding blockbuster treatments is going to be a huge challenge.
So is this a bit of a downer, given everything that we've heard on cancer over the last, decades, really, isn't it? Because it really feels as though we're making massive strides on that.
Well, we are and we aren't. So it depends which bit of cancer you want to look at. And there have been huge strides, genuinely huge strides in very particular types of cancer. But if you look at somebody who has stage 4 lung cancer that has already spread around the body, 5-year survival is about 5%. Still, that is very, very low survival rates. And it's about how do you tackle those kinds of cases. And their conclusion is that if you can, one, focus more on prevention, and there is really interesting science about new ways of preventing. It's not just stop smoking, you know, don't be obese. All of those things are important, but there is new science around preventing cancers as well. But also, this study has developed better ways of predicting who will develop cancer.
Right. Detection, blood tests and such to get it much earlier.
Early detection is one route. Which people's cancers are more likely to come back. So even though you think you've had surgery to remove it, can you actually predict whose cancers are more likely to come back? Those new ideas are coming out of this kind of research. So again, that helps you circumnavigate some of that evolutionary power of the cancer if you can get it while it's still in small quantities inside the body.
James Gallagher. Next to Ecuador, and police in that country say that they found the bodies of 6 inmates hanged inside a cell in one of the country's most dangerous prisons, the Litoral Penitentiary, in the coastal city of Guayaquil. Prison wardens say they discovered the bodies inside the victims' cells early on Wednesday. Our America's editor Leonardo Rocha reports.
The security forces have been carrying out cell-to-cell searches to check if there are other victims in the compound. The worst prison riots in Ecuador's history have happened inside the Guayaquil penitentiary, but prison violence has become common across the country. More than 400 inmates have died in the past 2 years. The violence is attributed to rival gangs who've intensified their fight for control of the country's jails since being hired by Mexico's powerful drug cartels a few years ago.
Leonardo Rocha. Buckingham Palace has confirmed that King Charles's youngest son, Prince Harry, will attend his coronation in London next month, despite their public rift. The palace said the prince's wife, Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, would remain at home in California in the United States with their children. The couple's falling out with his family has led to them leaving the UK, stepping back from their royal roles and laying bare all their grievances in a book and TV series. Here's our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond.
The invitation to the Sussexes went out months ago. Their response came just over 3 weeks before the coronation itself. The Palace and the Sussexes issued identical statements. Neither invitation nor acceptance should be read as an indication that the simmering anger between Harry and the rest of the royal family has abated, but instead that this event is beyond family quarrel. There's no indication yet from the palace as to what part Prince Harry will play on the day, but it's likely to be limited to attending the service at Westminster Abbey. He's no friend of high ceremony, and the balcony of Buckingham Palace is likely to be for working royals only. The Duchess and the couple's children, Prince Archie and Princess Lilibet, will remain in California. Neither the palace nor the Sussexes' communications team offered an explanation, but a source close to the Sussexes drew attention to the date of the coronation, the same day as Prince Archie's birthday. It appears the Duchess has chosen to celebrate that over her father-in-law's coronation.
Johnny Diamond. Still to come, a UK company that designs a third of the world's banknotes says the global demand for currency has fallen to its lowest level in 20 years. We'll be right back after this.
The attacker had very good knowledge of banking systems.
$2.1 billion in stolen funds.
It's a cyber criminal group.
It was the Lazarus Group again.
These are smart guys.
The Lazarus Heist is back for a brand new season.
We're following the latest twists and turns in the incredible story of the Lazarus Group hackers.
The Lazarus Heist, Season 2, from the BBC World Service.
Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. The United States says that it wants two-thirds of all new cars sold within a decade to be electric. It's announced new targets for cutting greenhouse gas emissions from vehicles. With the details, here's Simon Ponsford.
This is the latest step in President Biden's push for the mass adoption of electric cars. The US Environmental Protection Agency says radical cuts in vehicle pollution will improve air quality, boost people's health and save money for owners. If all goes to plan, new electric cars will make up two-thirds of the market by 2032. Last year, it was some 5%. Factors such as battery charging infrastructure and the availability of low-carbon fuels and minerals will play a crucial part. One car industry expert said a lot would have to go right for the new targets to be met.
Simon Ponsford. Well, Larry Burns worked for General Motors for 40 years. Part of his job was overseeing research into electric cars. James Menendez asked him what's his view on the latest plan.
I certainly think it's urgent for automobiles to pivot from being based on oil and gasoline to being based on electricity. But the scale of that change, both in the United States and around the world, is massive. And we have to learn about consumer acceptance of electric vehicles, the infrastructure for supplying the electricity, the technology that enables them, and we need to invest an awful lot of capital and engineering resources. We need to get to this end goal as quickly as we can, but sometimes it makes sense to go a little bit slower up front and learn how to scale before you scale.
Don't we know what the technology is? Don't we already have the technology? And in terms of scale, hasn't a company like Tesla shown that these things can be scaled up very quickly?
There's an enormous amount of innovation going on in new battery technology, new materials for anodes and cathodes and electrolytes. There are concerns about the supply chain for the mainstream batteries used today, lithium in particular. To believe we can go beyond Tesla's scale to something on the order of 10 million vehicles a year in the United States, I think that's unproven at this point in time.
9 years is quite a long time, though, isn't it?
Well, not in terms of what we're talking about. First of all, 10 million vehicles would be on the order of 100 to 200 new models that would have to be sold if each model sold 50 to 100,000 a year, which is a general rule of thumb. That would equate to on the order of 40 to 50 new automobile assembly plants. The auto industry can't go from making all combustion vehicles to making 10 million electric vehicles in one step. It takes 3 to 4 years to bring a new car to market. It takes a couple years in front of that to validate the technologies that go into it.
But shouldn't the big car companies, shouldn't they have started making this transition 10 or 20 years ago? We knew the direction of travel. If they're saying it's not enough time now, well, then maybe they should have started earlier.
They have. We've been developing electric vehicles since the middle 90s, and the technology has continued to improve, and I remain very optimistic about the technology. Please recognize, James, it's not just the battery and it's not just the electric vehicle, it's also the electric grid, it's the recharging infrastructure, and it's the supply base that enables all of that. So yes, there's an urgency to make this transition. There was a point in history where we lived through something similar. It was in the 1970s when fuel economy, safety, and emission standards were all implemented at the same time. And a company like General Motors decided to radically change all of its cars in a short window of time. And the result was not good. The quality of execution wasn't what it needed to be. And it just was the wrong move to try to go that fast. So I'm just simply saying there's a lot of new electric cars coming out in 2023, 2024, 2025. Let the industry have a chance to learn off of that. To put that in perspective, James, the F-150 Lightning and the Chevy Bolt both had a very small handful of issues with their batteries, and both of them had to shut down their plants to deal with that. And you don't want to try to force the scale before you know you've got this right.
Larry Burns, former Corporate Vice President of Research and Development at General Motors. A picture posted on Instagram promoting an eyeshadow range by the French fashion company Dior has prompted an angry backlash from people in China and elsewhere. Many people said that the image promoted a derogatory and racist stereotype of Asians. There's been no comment from Dior, but the post has since been deleted. Kerry Allen, our China media analyst, told me more about it.
It's a post that was meant to promote its new line of beauty products. So it's a close-up of an image of an eye wearing eyeshadow on an Asian model. But you can see the model is using one of her fingers to push up the outside of her eye. And a lot of the social media comments that appeared off the back of this, before the post was deleted, said things like, this is racial discrimination, both in Chinese and in English. So the post has now been deleted. And even though Instagram blocked in mainland China, massive media attention on this today, lots of criticism about this post.
You lived for some time in China. Are you surprised that there's been this level of sensitivity about this image?
Not at all, no. I have seen over the years countless cases of big brands posting things that upset Chinese communities, anger Chinese communities. And often what will happen is state media, newspapers like the Global Times, for example, a big national newspaper that pay close attention to foreign affairs, they will actively call for a boycott to the extent that China being a massive market for luxury brands, you will get big companies that will issue apologies. It doesn't matter how big and successful they are in the international community. They will apologize because there is a recognition that this could really affect their Chinese market. But I think it's important to mention that Dior is a French brand, and this comes very shortly on the heels of President Xi Jinping meeting President Macron in Beijing. And a lot of people, a lot of media saw this as a very successful event. So it's something that actually shows that on the surface, there might be a lot of positive about China and France working together more closely. But something like this can very quickly ripple relations between the two countries.
And the sense that underneath the surface, there's this sort of level of disrespect, if you like, from the West towards Chinese people and the Chinese nation as a whole.
Yeah, definitely. Yes. I think that's why we keep on hearing stories like this, that there are feelings that big brands have a responsibility to play when they represent Chinese models. And there is a feeling that this could be a form of soft power in effect that kind of creates images of how Chinese people should be perceived in a negative way. But at the same time, there are some in China who feel quite strongly that people shouldn't get so sensitive about this within the country. They're saying maybe we should actually show less cultural sensitivity and actually try and embrace things like this.
China media analyst Kerry Allen. To a story coming out of Britain now, and a company based in Hampshire in southern England, which designs a third of the world's banknotes, says the global demand for currency has fallen to its lowest level in 20 years. De La Rue warned that the drop would hit its full-year profits, causing its share price to fall by as much as 30%. Our business reporter Noor Nanji explains.
The number of people using contactless and online payments has been rising around the world. But De La Rue insisted that was not the reason for the current downturn in cash. It told the BBC when COVID struck, central banks stocked up on banknotes, as they often do during crises. They are now delaying new orders as they run through their stocks. The last time demand for cash fell so low was after the millennium, when a similar thing happened. Central banks had stocked up on banknotes, wary of the millennium bug, then burned through their stock. De La Rue is now having to renegotiate its own loan agreements. But the printing company, which is more than 200 years old, said there were signs of a recovery.
Nor Nanji. Scientists say that they've developed a robotic hand that can grasp and handle delicate objects, as well as sensing what it's touching. The mechanical hand was trained using a range of objects, including a peach, a computer mouse, and a roll of bubble wrap. Researchers say that the technology could have many uses, including potentially helping with some medical tests. Razia Iqbal has been speaking to Fumia Lida, a professor of robotics at the University of Cambridge and one of the authors of the research. She asked him first what was new about this robotic hand.
So what we're interested in is what the human can do but robot cannot do, and especially in the context of manipulation, such as cooking, the peeling of onions, and also folding of papers and so on. So what we're interested in is something a human is really, really good at with their hands, but the robots cannot do today, and that's something we're trying to solve with our technologies.
And what is it that you've come up with that suggests to you that this robotic hand is far better than any that we've seen before?
So one of the challenges we have been facing in the robotic hand is the sense of touch. Like most of the robotic arms, the robotic hands, don't have a sense of touch. And what we are trying to do is making sensors, but not just one or two, but you can put a lots of sensors so that you can detect different kind of interactions. And most of the robotic hands are very rigid. They use plastics or other hard materials, whereas what we are trying to do now is making hands more soft, like using rubber and silicone that make a robotic hand more soft. On top of that, we want to include the sensors, but including a sensor, electronics in soft materials is not really easy things. And that is one of the breakthroughs we made, that we are actually able to put soft sensors in the soft hand so that you can have an easier interaction with variations of objects.
So, for example, a human hand would find it very easy not to squeeze too hard on an egg. Would this robot hand be able to do that too?
Yes, absolutely. So the robot can actually have a sensor to check the interaction with the objects, not just touching or grasping an egg, but it's also able to detect what's wrong with the interaction. When eggs are slipping off from your hands, for example, and the robotic hand can detect it and correct its actions.
What do you think are the potential applications for the use of this robotic hand?
There are many, many manual laborers in our society, including agriculture or some retailer operations or hospital operations. Our robotic technologies can actually potentially help this kind of challenging manual operations.
And what about areas of medicine and also prosthetics? Because presumably it will allow people who need to have a hand replaced if they've lost their limb, that somehow this might be much more effective than just a prosthetic hand.
Yes, absolutely. Most of the conventional prosthetic hands don't have a sense of touch. We are able to make a robotic hand more like a human hand, and they can actually feel what they're touching and how they're interacting with the objects. And hopefully we can improve the quality of life for the prosthetic users in the future.
Fumia Lida, Professor of Robotics at the University of Cambridge. Now, I'm not sure whether this is a good news story or a bad news story. New York City, which has an estimated 2 million rats, has appointed its first rat czar. Kathleen Corradi beat 900 applicants to become the city's Director of Rodent Mitigation. Her salary could be as high as $170,000. From New York, Pratishka Gildiyar reports.
A few months ago, when the position of rat czar was advertised, it asked with great fanfare for a highly motivated and somewhat bloodthirsty candidate. And now it sounds like the city's administration has found her. Kathleen Corradi, a former school teacher, has been tasked with controlling New York's ever-growing rodent population.
Rats and the conditions that support their thriving will no longer be tolerated in New York City. No more dirty curbs, unmanaged spaces, or brazen burrowing. There's a new sheriff in town. And with your help, we'll send those rats packing.
In the past, the city has tried various methods to destroy their population, including poisoning and drowning. No doubt, the new rat czar has a tough job ahead of her.
That was Pratikshka Gildial in New York reporting on the city's first rat czar. And that is all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Alana Bowles. The producer was Leah McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Mars, and until next time, goodbye.